Over the last decade before October 12th, 539 BC, a man named Cyrus II, who is also known to us as Cyrus the Great, had been spending his time working diligently in the Persian Empire to expand and develop the Persian Empire as far as land was concerned. He managed to do something over those 10 years that no Persian before him had been able to do. He united all of the Persian tribes into one unit. Not only did he unite the Persian tribes into a unit, but he was also able to talk to the Medes and convince the Medes to join the Persians so that they could be one single force to be reckoned with as they started expanding their empire. Now, both the Medes and the Persians come from the same history. They are descendants from tribes that moved out from the Russian plains up in what we know as Russia. They came down and they found themselves in two separate tribes, the Persians and the Medes, but they came from the same basic history. So when they joined forces, Cyrus II or Cyrus the Great started expanding his empire. Over the next few years, he would lay a foundation so that he could start reaching out. And by the end of the Persian Empire, he will have moved his way through the entire known world into Egypt, wiped Egypt out, moved his way down all the way to Ethiopia. And it was basically at Ethiopia that his reign stopped there as far as expanse. On this particular journey, he had some commanders that he sent out. Gubaru was one of the commanders. He was a Mede, and he was sent out. And Gubaru had made an incredible progress down the Tigris and Euphrates River. He took Opis on the Tigris River. He moved his way down past the Tigris River, and he took Sippar. Now, the reason that those two places are significant is the next place on the map is Babylon, the city of Babylon on the Euphrates River. And this guy, with the armies under the direction of General Ugbaru, they came down and they ended up on the Euphrates River heading toward Babylon. Why is this all significant? Because on October 12, 539 BC, after both these cities had been taken and they're on the verge of taking Babylon, the people in Babylon should have been on battle ready. They should have had people on every wall. They should have been ready for battle. But instead, what are they doing on October 12th? They are partying in the big hall. Why? Because if you remember when we walked into captivity a couple of weeks ago and we walked into Babylon, remember the city of Babylon, how big it was, how the expanse was so incredible, how the walls were built around the city, not just once, but twice with a wall inside a wall, how they built such a fortress that as far as they were concerned, nobody, and I mean nobody, was going to be able to breach the walls of Babylon. You know what happened? This guy, Gubaru, had a brilliant idea. When he got to Babylon, they took the Euphrates River, which at this time was running straight through the city of Babylon, and that was why Babylon figured they could survive forever, because they had running water. It ran under the wall on one side and under the wall on the other side. They went, they took the Euphrates River, they built a huge dam, diverted the water of the Euphrates around Babylon, and guess what happened to the water level? It sunk down low enough that the wall where the river had gone under was exposed. And so one night, quietly, without incident, an entire Persian and Midian army walked under the wall of Babylon into the city, walked into a party, and slaughtered a king. And they took over a city in one night like that without a fight. That happened on October 12th, and it was under the direction of Gubaru, who is also known in history as Darius the Mede. And Darius the Mede, we find out in chapter 5, walks into Babylon the very night that Belshazzar is having his big party, slaughters Belshazzar, and without a fight takes over Babylon. Boom, just like that. And on that special night, Daniel has just walked in. He's interpreted writing on the wall, and he's walked out with the purple coat on, and Darius the Mede is now in charge of Babylon under the leadership of Cyrus the Great. So the Persian Empire is under Cyrus. Darius is the guy Cyrus puts in charge over the city of Babylon because he conquered it. Now let's take a look at Daniel's context for a second. Remember, this is Daniel's story. Daniel walks into Babylon under Babylonian under the Babylonian Empire. He walks in as a teenager. He starts as a man of integrity with his three friends. They do the whole food thing. That leads to some good stuff, which eventuates in his three friends being thrown into a fiery furnace. That's never a good idea, but they walk out of that. He then goes through the up and down emotional ride of Nebuchadnezzar, where he's constantly in danger of his life. But Nebuchadnezzar, after some serious persuasion eating grass for a long time, ends up believing in God. And for 7 years, he reigns believing in God, under which Daniel and his friends prosper. Then he dies, and 23 years go by of general obscurity as far as the Bible's concerned in Daniel's story, and it is at the end of the 23 years that we're standing on October 12, 539 BC, staring at a wall with four words on it and a king who's scared to death. And Daniel walks right back into the story and says, "Let me tell you what God's telling you." Then can you imagine what it must have been like for Daniel to walk out of that room, and by the next morning, it was no longer a Babylonian empire, it was a Persian empire, just like that, boom. And if you were the Jewish people, and perhaps even Daniel, you had to sit back at that point and ask yourself, what does this mean for us? I mean, we came in under Babylonian captivity, now the Persians have taken over. Does that mean we're going home? Does it mean we're staying? Do they like us? Don't they like us? Are they going to kill us? What's going to happen? So we jump into the story at that exact moment where all of this is taking place. Turn in your Bibles, if you will, to the book of Daniel in chapter 6, page 620 of our Bibles. They're under the chairs if you don't have one of your own. Grab one of our Bibles, turn to page 620, and we're in Daniel chapter 6. Before we read Daniel chapter 6, verse 1, let's jump back to Daniel chapter 5, verse 30, and just look at what it says there. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62, October 12, 539 BC. There it is. In verse 1, it says, it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. Now, that's an interesting verse starting out there, because what does that say about Daniel? You see, Daniel lived in general obscurity for 23 years as far as we're concerned, but as far as Babylon's concerned, it is clear here that he was anything but obscure. Because when Darius walks in and he has to make a choice about which three people in all of Babylon are going to be the administrators that rule Babylon, one of them he picks is who? Daniel. So Daniel must have come with an incredible reputation after those 23 years of a man that wasn't only a man of integrity, but a man capable of doing what he said he was going to do. But it doesn't stop there. In verse 3 it says, now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Isn't that pretty cool? Listen, just a quick side note here. If you ever want to read through the scriptures and ask yourself, what does God call me to as a Christ follower? Read that verse and stick there. Here is a man that because he follows God, his character, his integrity, his discipline, the way he lives his life is of such quality and of such depth that no matter what he finds his hands doing, you constantly hear of Daniel, and he so distinguished himself because of his exceedingly great character. And as believers, that should be our story. We should be the ones, wherever we find ourselves, being distinguished, not because we are trying to distinguish ourselves, but because our character and integrity and way of life and way of handling situations and way of handling people is so extraordinary that people go, wow. And we miss the boat as Christ followers when we don't live in that world. So Daniel once again experiences what he's been experiencing since he walked into Babylon. He lives his life the way God calls him to, and it leads to incredible opportunity because he is a man that is extraordinary. And then we jump into this neat story. In verse 4 it says, at this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God. I love that statement. that men are searching diligently to find something in Daniel's life that they can go, this deserves them to get fired, and they can't do it. And finally they say, we've got a plan. If he has to pick between his God and anything else, he'll always pick his God. Let's work something out to make that a problem. Isn't that amazing? Wouldn't that be an amazing thing to be said of us? Look, you can't find fault in these people, but I tell you what, if you're going to find fault, you're going to find fault in one place. They will follow their God above and beyond anything else they do. Wow. And why do they want to do this? The usual story. Daniel's going to be in charge. They're mad, and they want to get rid of him. So they come up with this brilliant plan. They go to Darius, who is a brand new ruler in the city. He's only been ruling for a short period of time now. And you know how it is when you're a brand new ruler. You're trying to make sure that you're establishing your authority and do all of that. And they walk in and they get all their buddies together and they come into the old hall and they say to Darius, listen, Darius, here's the deal. We and all of our leaders, I mean, they got the whole crew except probably for Daniel. And there they all stand like, you know, Daniel's busy right now. You know, he had an errand to run or something. But he's, I'm sure he's with us on this one because he loves you. Here's the deal. We think that you should set a decree that for the next 30 days, you should have everybody in the city pray only to you. And if they pray to any other god except for you, well, then you're going to throw them into the lion's den. Because here's the deal. You got to establish your authority. And you know, the kings before you did it. Nebi set up a big statue. That was cool. Some other guys did some other stuff. You need something to say, look, I'm in charge. And we think you deserve this. You're a good guy. We like you. And I mean, look, 30 days, what's it going to do? I mean, anybody could go 30 days without praying to their God and pray to you, and then they can go back praying to their other gods. It's all cool. And so Darius goes, you know, I think that's a good idea. If you ever want to get somebody, if you ever want to cause somebody to falter in being a good man or a good woman, speak to their pride. It works out really well. Let me just, this little side note for a second. Whenever pride gets in your way, it will always lead to a problem. You hear me? Whenever pride is a decision-making process for you, you're always going to find yourself going, oh no, what have I done? And here we're going to see the exact story play out. Darius is standing there. He goes, good idea. He writes the decree. The second he writes the decree, here's what happens. Look at this. Verse 10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room with a window open toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Wow! Unbelievable. Now, first of all, if a decree is written, I bet that most of us in this room certainly wouldn't run home, open our windows, and start praying. And Daniel was not doing this as some statement or some way of saying, look at me. It simply says, Daniel read the decree, and I bet when Daniel read that decree, he probably sat down for a second and said, God, here we go again. And he went home and did what he did every other day. He opened his windows to face Jerusalem, which I think is an extraordinary statement of Daniel's trust in the promises of God, knowing that someday they would walk back into God's promise. He opens the windows up and he stares out to where Jerusalem is going to be or is and is going to be again. He gets down on his knees and here's what he does. He gives thanks to God. I love that. Look, I mean, if I had the courage in his circumstance to walk away from a decree like that and to go and pray for those 30 days, unfaltering in my following of God, I don't know that my first prayer would be getting on my knees and saying, God, I just want to tell you thank you so much for the life I get to love. This is extraordinary. I might be on my knees going, God, hello? Are you seeing this? Have you got a plan? Have you figured this out? Because this is once again a disaster zone. I mean, we almost had the free world in our hands again. I mean, it's like you were handing it to me, and now what? Now I'm going to get thrown in some lion's den. But no, not Daniel. Daniel gets up there and he says, God, thank you for what you do. And guess what? His little friends, they know how this plays out. Daniel is predictable. He's a man of character, integrity. He's a man of diligence. He's not negligent. And he always loves his God. That's his predictability. And they go and stand there and they watch and they watch. And they're like, wait for it. Windows open. Here it goes. He's on his knees. Go tell Darius quick. And they all run back to Darius. And when they get back to Darius, they start talking. And they walk to Darius. And they said to Darius, King Darius, let's take a look here for a second. in verse 13. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, paid no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel, and he made every effort until sundown to save him. He was greatly distressed. I'm sure he was. Have you ever been in those moments in life where you're working at something, and someone's feeding your pride and and suddenly you wake up one morning and you realize the trap that's been set, and you're like, oh no, oh no, this is not good. I mean, I bet the second those guys walked in and said, King, Daniel prayed, I bet the king right there went, oh man, what have I done? I know exactly what these guys are up to. And I bet that that day, as he's trying to rescue Daniel, that's when he's getting all of his wise men around going, okay, we got to figure this thing out. The decree is wrong. It's a stupid decree. I don't know who came up with it, but we got to fix it because this is ridiculous. Daniel is a man of integrity. He loves his God. He's done nothing but great things, and we are going to change this. And it ends basically with this statement. So, in verse 15, then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. Wow. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. Man, this king, he really did not want Daniel to go in the lion's den. This is not like Nebuchadnezzar. But he got himself in this mess because of his pride. He didn't sleep that night, and he comes back the next morning and he shouts down and he goes, Daniel, servant of the living God, in verse 20, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king. At that, the king does what every good Persian or Babylonian or probably everybody before or after them does. He took all of the people that were part of the conspiracy, took their families, cast them into the lion's den, and they were devoured by the lions. Now, I don't highly recommend you treat your enemies that way, and I don't say that that's necessarily a biblical way of dealing with anyone, but then again, these guys weren't particularly biblical, were they? Because they were the guys struggling to figure God out, and here's the deal. Watch this. In verse 26, it says, I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. And in verse 28, so Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, you know, once again, we're back in one of those stories like the fiery furnace, right? We read this and we're like, woo! Go, Daniel, go, Daniel! He's out of the lion's den. It's incredible. I love it. God rescued him once again. And look, the whole world has changed and Darius is declaring God, God. It's amazing, isn't it? But I mean, listen, folks, when I read this story, I sit back and I'm just like, okay, hold on a second. Do you guys get the feeling at all that's a little weird for Daniel? I mean, do you think that at any point in time as Daniel's praying and then he gets arrested, then he gets pulled in and now the lion's den's going to happen, that he doesn't go, God, I think I've been through this a couple of times. I mean, at what point do you get to the place where your circumstances are playing out so well and things are looking so right and you're looking back and you're going, God, thank you for all the hard times I've gone through because finally it's turning out. And then it just ends up not turning out and you're like, what? I'm back in the lion's den. And you have to understand when you're lowering somebody into a lion's den, the way they did lion's dens back here is they dig a big, huge pit in the ground, right? And they'd put a bunch of lions down there and they'd have a hole that sinks down into the lion's den and it's dark down there. And then they would feed the lions through the hole with big chunks of meat. Then they would starve them, then they would feed them again, then they would starve them, and then they'd throw a human down there and they'd see what the lions do. I mean, this isn't like tame, neat little zoo lions that are like, hi. These lions were designed to tear people apart. And as you're getting lowered in there, I am sure Daniel wasn't going down into the lion's den going, it's all cool. Don't worry about it. I mean, you know, we watch the cartoons with the angel sitting next to Daniel on the lowering. And it just doesn't pan out that way. Daniel gets down there. The lions don't devour him. And he says, God did choose to rescue me this time. You know, this morning I woke up and I went into my room, and I didn't go into my room. I went downstairs, studied, came back up, and I said to Brooke, listen, last week I brought the kids with me to service, first service. They all sat here. My son ran around looking for paper airplanes while I was preaching, to the point that I eventually stopped preaching and said, Cullen, please sit down and draw. And then he didn't have a pad of paper, so I had to ask the congregation to search for a pad of paper and a pen in the middle of my preaching. So I said to Brooke, I just need a break today. The unsupervised three children in the front row are not panning out so well for me. And so I'm like, I'm not taking them with me. So I go back to my daughter, 9 years old, and I knew what was going to ensue from this one, right? So I walk into her room, and I'm like, Hadley, I need to talk to you for a second. And we sit down, and I say, look, honey, here's the deal. I'm going to give you two options, and I want you to pick one of these two options. Option one, you can come to all three services with me. You can go to kids ministry, the first service, when there's no supervision. You can go with mommy into the second service, and then in the third service, you can serve like you always do in the kids ministry. Or you can come to the second and third service, go to kids ministry during the second service, and sit in during the third service, which I'm fine with, because she's nine and she doesn't need supervision like the others do, right? So Hadley goes, she thinks for a second, and she goes, okay, Dad, I want to come to first service and go to main church. And I go, okay, hold on. Maybe I didn't explain myself correctly. That actually wasn't one of the two options. That is a third option, which is the normal option, which we are not doing today. So let me explain it again, and I go through the whole thing again. And she goes, no, Dad, I don't want to do either of those. I want to go to first service and sit in the main church. And I go, no, look, let me explain it one last third time before we start getting into this, and let me make myself abundantly clear. These are the two options, the only two options, and you get to pick one of them, and if you don't pick one, I will pick one for you, and you won't like it. And so we start, and guess what? Without a doubt, tears start rolling, and she goes, but I want to go to first service. And I go, you, in your room, we're done with this discussion. You're lucky if you even get to go to church today. Wasn't quite that bad, but it was almost that bad. And I send her into her room, and she goes in her room, and I go, and I get in the shower, and I'm standing in the shower, and I'm like, God, come on, really? I mean, why am I derailing every Sunday morning before church? I mean, I got to preach. I got to think. I've got Medes and Persians in my head. I can't do this. And I'm standing in the shower, and suddenly that little whisper comes and he goes, hey, Renaud, would you look a little harder? And I go, look harder at what? He goes, look a little harder at what just happened. And I start thinking about it. And it was almost as if that magical moment that you never want to occur occurs. And it's like a mirror pops in front of my face. And he goes, what you just witnessed is exactly the way you guys always respond to stuff. See, here's the deal. My 9-year-old daughter had a set of circumstances that were normal to her. They made sense to her. They were what made life work. And I walked into those set of circumstances and threw her a curveball. And when the curveball hit, her immediate response was not and will not be, dear Dad, I know you love me. I know you do all things for my benefit and for the benefit of our family. And so I am going to trust you completely, despite the fact that this is not what I think should be happening or how it should be working. I know you are wiser than me, and I will submit myself to whatever you have. No, of course not. She's going to go, no, I want to go to first service. And God goes, you know how many times a minute on this planet I deal with people going, no, I don't want those circumstances. What are you thinking? Who are you? Why are you there? Are you listening? Why is this happening to me? I've already gone through this enough times. Ever been there? Have you been one of those human beings that God has to deal with every 2 minutes? Yes, so have I. And God went, listen, Renaud. Sometimes when circumstances change unpredictably, those circumstances drive us into a place where instead of trusting God, we suddenly find ourselves completely going insane. And that's what your daughter just did. And that's normal. That's what she does. That's what you do. So we need to deal with this. And it got me thinking. A couple years ago, I was in Monterey, California. I was a student ministries pastor in Monterey, California. And my dad had made the decision to stay in the U.S., and so he was a military man, resigned from the military, lost his pension, all that stuff, started from scratch in his late 40s in the U.S. And for a few years, my dad, who was commander of military bases and had, you know, was one of those guys, he touches it, turns to gold. I mean, just a brilliant guy and just an amazing man and a man of integrity and character. I mean, reminds me a lot of what you start seeing in Daniel like this. Just a man that just was predictable. He did what was right. And so he starts in business in Africa, and Africa is like Babylon. It's like the most corrupt and horrible continent on the planet, though I love it deeply because it's my home. But I mean, you walk into Africa, you got to be ready, man. You got to be ready to deal with stuff because it's third world and there's a lot of struggle there and a lot of pain. And so people learn to survive in that world and it becomes ugly. So my dad works in Africa, and for years, though my dad stands on integrity, his integrity costs him every time. You know, you do things by the book there and it just fails you, right? So, we're praying as a family. We all love God. My dad's a great man. He's going to do great things with what God blesses him with. We're praying and praying and praying. And for years we pray, and God seems to be relatively silent. Okay, and my dad's business opportunities keep derailing completely because he's a man of integrity and he won't compromise, right? So finally, I'm a student ministries pastor, and my dad's working in the coffee stuff, right? This is at the height of the market. Coffee stuff is booming, and my dad gets an opportunity in Sierra Leone to get coffee. He gets these coffee trucks filled with coffee. They're in Freetown in the harbor. They're going to get shipped out the next morning. It's going to hit the U.S. There's going to be big money involved. Finally, we made it. Everything's taken care of. Financial security, the whole deal, right? So I'm excited. We're all excited. We're like, God, thank you for all the hard times you've taken us through, because it's all worth it now. And that night in Freetown, while we're celebrating, the rebels came into Freetown. Remember Blood Diamond? That night happened that night. My dad's in Freetown hiding under a house with a gun on his chest, wondering if he's going to survive the night. His coffee trucks all got burned to the ground. Everything that we'd invested and hoped for, gone. The level of debt my parents were in just went through the roof again, and there we sit. And I get the call after my dad crawled his way out of Freetown and got back to the U.S. that at least he's alive. And I remember sitting down and just going, look, God, here's the deal. I'm in ministry. I think I'm stuck with this job now. It's all I'm good at. So I'm going to keep doing it. And I'm stuck with you because, unfortunately, I believe in you. And there's no turning back from that. So I'm going to follow you. But I don't like it. I just want to be clear. And I don't know that we're going to talk very much for a while. Because either you're not listening, or worse, you just don't care. And so I struggled through those months with what it looks like when you seem to be doing everything by the book, everything right, everything with integrity, and every time you're on the verge of some greatness, you end up getting lowered back into a lion's den somewhere going, what happened? What happened? And there I sat in that dark world going, wow, how do you swallow this one? During those years, some big things happened. And let me just tell you something. The next year, the coffee trucks didn't resurrect and appear in the U.S. My dad didn't make any money. The debt didn't go away. And for years beyond that, it just got worse, not better. So it wasn't like, I got a great story. We got pulled out of the lion's den the next day. It was fantastic. No, there was no great story. For months and months and years, it just kept plummeting into more darkness. And you're like, really? And during those years, God called Brooke and I into church planting. So we looked all over the country, and we sensed God's leading to come here to Claremont, Florida, and we planted here in Florida. And we started a little church called Ocean then that turned into Mosaic, and 6 years ago, now it's this, right? And this all unfolded. And those first years at Mosaic, we had nothing. So you know what we did? We traveled from aerobics rooms in the Lord's gym where it looked like there were 100 of us worshiping, because the 10 of us that were there reflected in every one of the 19 mirrors around us. And we're like, wow, there's so many of us. It was a great strategic move on my part, and really weird as well. And we bounced around from different places into warehouses and different things. And during those years, with nothing available to us, we bled together and we served together and we became a family. And because we became that family, that DNA spilled out into becoming what we today know as Mosaic Church. Now, funnily enough, a couple of years after that, after we'd moved here and after we'd planted and after we'd struggled, some things in my dad's business did take off, and they took off really well, and my dad did really well. And because he did, God provided for this church through him. And my dad turned out to be just one of those guys that I thought he would be, where he gives most of what he has away. And my mom and dad serve this world in huge ways and do amazing things, and things did turn around. And I wonder still to this day, as I look back, if my coffee trucks, or my dad's coffee trucks, had made it out of Freetown and he'd suddenly become a multimillionaire and everything was hunky-dory, would I have chosen to plant a church? I don't know. If I had chosen, would I have come to Claremont, Florida? I don't think so. If I had never come to Claremont, Florida, would the story have ever emerged the way it has? And if I'd come here and my dad had money back when we started this church and he could throw money our way so we could have whatever we want, would we have ever bled together and laughed together and cried together? No. And would we have ever had a family? No. And you start calculating out the amount of ripples that occurred because some coffee trucks were burned in Freetown, and suddenly you breathe deeply and go, wow, would I ever take that moment back? Now that's hindsight, right? And hindsight, I love hindsight. Woo! Look, we're out of the lion's den. Yeah, great. But you know, at some point, hindsight has to translate into forward vision, doesn't it? At some point, enough hindsight has to translate into this fact that God is actually at work caring for me and for the family. In Romans 8:28, God puts it this way, I will work all things out for the good of those who love me and are called according to my purpose. In James chapter 1 and verse 2 through 4, he says, consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that it is the testing of your faith that develops perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work in you so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. And I stand here and I realize, wow. Sometimes when we're in the middle of being the next great leader of Babylon and instead we find ourselves being lowered into a lion's den, sometimes when we're in the middle of those places and we want to go completely nuts, we should remind ourselves that the God we serve is in control and that he does care. And though this story is not about us, that God is working out a much bigger story about the whole family, the whole church, he cares enough about each individual in that family that he is always working to make sure that the big story does not end because of the little story and that the little story does not end because of the big story. That both matter to him. And he happens to have the wisdom and the power to work that out. I went back into Hadley's room this morning and I sat down with her after the incident and said, Hadley, you know, Dad has a plan he's working out to make things work because you're 9 years old, to be able to come to service by yourself sometimes so that you can enjoy it. And I have to teach your brothers and sisters some other things they need to do. But I can't do that if we stick to the current plan, so I've changed the plan. And I really need you to help me as you learn to trust that when Dad's making decisions, that they're decisions that are going to be best for you. And I said to Hadley, you know, when you trust me, then things turn out really well, don't they? And when you don't trust me, they turn into a disaster zone morning where we're shouting at each other. Which life would you like to live? And as I'm speaking the words to Hadley, God's going, are you listening? record it, playback. I'm like, I got it. We already talked in the shower. And God's whispering to me saying, Renaud, do you trust me? Do you trust me? Do you trust me? I don't know what your circumstances are today. I don't know what you're dealing with. I don't know how dark your world is right now or how light your world is right now. But I can tell you this, that the God I serve, the God that offers himself as a savior to every single one of us, that God tells us that whatever the circumstances are you find yourself in, he is at work in them, developing in you exactly what is necessary for the story to unfold exactly the way it ought to. And as he's doing that in you, if you can just learn to let go of the circumstances like Hadley could have this morning and say, Father, I know that you love me and that you're working out what is best for me. So despite circumstances, good or bad, I will trust you. A freedom will emerge in your life that is so extraordinary you won't know what to do with it. And it's not always easy to say those words, but those words come out of a deep part of believing that what God has done and what he will do is always for the good of your story and the story of history at the same time. It would be nice, wouldn't it, if God showed up once in a while and explained to us what he was up to? Hey, just so you know, I know you're struggling right now, but it's all good because there's what I'm working out. Can I suggest to you that he already has? His word is full of promises that say, just so you know, here's what I'm up to. If you're not in his word regularly, then you ain't hearing his explanation. In which case, I'm not surprised that you and I find ourselves going, no, I want to go to first service, and that's the end of that. Instead of going, I trust you. You've already explained it to me. Stay in his word, learn to trust him, and as you do that, walk into the freedom that God has for you. Just like Daniel. And boy, what a freedom it will be. Let's